Houston's police chief blames the boyfriend loophole for the on-duty death of an officer. What is the boyfriend loophole? That story and a whole lot more coming up today on The Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. With support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. The president appears to be hours away from impeachment. Where are other presidents getting impeached? Why many Western democracies don't have it? Also, what could be the next boom industry in Texas? Rare earth mining. And a new law clears the way for a new crop. What's holding back hemp now? Plus a look back at the week that was in politics with the Texas Tribune and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets started right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this December 13th, 2019. Happy Friday, happy day. Everybody still focused like a laser beam on those impeachment hearings? It's quite possible most folks already think they know where all this is headed. One bit of a surprise, however, reported by CNN, that the Senate might not simply dismiss any articles of impeachment as widely expected. CNN quoting Texas Senator John Cornyn saying that rather than a motion to dismiss, the Senate leadership might try to, in Cornyn's words, decide this on a 51-vote threshold with the potential tie and all the recriminations that would flow from that. Close quote. In other words, CNN says a vote to acquit. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says no decision has been made on whether to do that. But if it does happen, it's easy to imagine the tweets that might be forthcoming from the White House, right? Senator Cornyn using his own Twitter account to respond to Houston's police chief, Art Acevedo, on Monday before escorting the body of slain Houston police officer Christopher Brewster to a funeral home. Acevedo told reporters, "Who killed our sergeant? A boyfriend abusing his girlfriend." And Acevedo went on to blame Senate Republicans for failing to reauthorize the Violence Against Women Act because of objections over the so-called boyfriend loophole. Senator Cornyn tweeted back that the chief was mistaken. The gunman was already prohibited from owning a firearm under Texas law. But wait just a moment. What is this boyfriend loophole? Here to help with that, Natalie Nanasi. She is director of the Hunter Legal Center for Victims of Crimes Against Women at SMU Law School. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
The boyfriend loophole. Were you familiar with it before Chief Acevedo started talking about it?
Oh, absolutely. The boyfriend loophole has been an issue now for a number of years.
What? Tell us what it is.
So basically, under the Violence Against Women Act, there are certain categories of people who have perpetrated domestic violence who are prohibited from possessing a firearm. Right now, that includes spouses, ex-spouses, people who are living together, people who share a child in common, but a boyfriend who abuses a girlfriend, or I should say also a girlfriend who abuses a boyfriend, it is gender neutral, can still access a gun.
How do you define, though, who a boyfriend would be, or a girlfriend for that matter?
Well, you know, that ends up being a matter, a fact that a court who's deciding this kind of case can decide. But you decide it the same way that you would decide that you would prove whether somebody is living with somebody else or not, right? Some of that, sometimes that isn't always so clear cut. There are shades of gray. And so you ask questions and you introduce proof in a court that demonstrates that these people are dating.
So what would be the theory if you had a boyfriend loophole patched prior to this officer's death in Houston? How could that have made a difference?
Well, in general, what the studies are showing now is that gun use is consistent across intimate partner relationships. And so there's no difference in the amount of violence that's being perpetrated by spouses or ex-spouses and boyfriends. And when you have a situation like we have here in the United States, when half of the women that are murdered here in this country are murdered by their intimate partners, we need to make sure that every type of intimate partnership is being covered.
You know, loophole is one of those squidgy words that generally is used by advocates for some kind of change in a law to to modify it to fit what they see is correct. What I'm trying to understand is why this provision wasn't included in the first place. Where has there been resistance in Congress?
You know, what's interesting is actually the Violence Against Women Act has been something. It was enacted in 1994, and it's been reauthorized three times since then. And in the first two reauthorizations in 2000 and 2005, there was broad bipartisan support for it. It actually passed unanimously in the Senate both of those times. It really wasn't until 2013 and now in this most recent reauthorization in 2019 that some of these issues have gotten to be controversial.
But what issues are we talking about? I mean, where's the controversy?
Well, I think the controversy, as far as I understand the position of the NRA, is that any expansion of protections having to do with guns is seen as an existential threat to gun rights in America. And so you are seeing, when there's support for increased protections and increased restrictions on gun rights, that the NRA is just opposing those.
Has this issue been responsible for stalling the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act, or no?
It's been a big part of it, not single-handedly. There are a number of other issues having to do with increasing protections for immigrant survivors, LGBT survivors, and Native American survivors of domestic violence that have also been controversial. But those, including the gun rights provisions, have definitely made it much more difficult to get bipartisan support like it has gotten in the past.
Natalie Nanasi is director of the Hunter Legal Center for Victims of Crimes Against Women at SMU Law School. Professor Nanasi, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard.
Anytime.
A lot of folks right now talking about impeachment, but where does it come from? Although Americans may tend to think of it as their own, it was a thing before there was a United States of America, and a few other countries still have it, but it is seldom used and far from universally incorporated, indeed in Latin America. Only Peru and Brazil can impeach their leaders. Brazil recently did just that, removing its president less than 4 years ago. Rick Nowak is a Washington Post reporter based in Berlin who's been exploring how and to what extent other Western-style democracies use this tool of impeachment. Rick, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's go back in time just a bit. I guess it was the British who first incorporated impeachment into their political dynamics. Is that right?
Yeah, many centuries ago, in fact. At the time, it was seen as a way to sort of respond to the mood of the people, to be able to depose officials and ministers who were seen in an unfavorable light by the British public. And that was really sort of the birth hour of the concept of impeachment.
But it's my understanding, though, that by the time the founding fathers of the United States were wrestling with whether and what to do with this concept of impeachment, it has sort of fallen out of favor in the UK.
It has. It hasn't been used in a very long time. It's basically now being considered obsolete in the UK. In theory, still something that does exist or could exist, but it's more about no confidence votes or other parliamentary mechanisms.
Now, why is that? Why do you think there is that sort of resistance or reluctance, perhaps, to use impeachment?
Right. I think it does depend a little bit on the political system. So if you have a presidential system, you sort of need the concept of impeachment, because there are very, very few other means through which you can impact a leader once he has been or she has been elected. In parliamentary democracies, that's a little bit different, because you can get rid of leaders quite easily. And I think that's the reason that explains why impeachment has become obsolete in a number of countries, including former British colonies.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. As you were looking at impeachment today, where do you still find it used? Or is it, I was thinking, I said Brazil, right? I mean, that happened less than 4 years back, but I think there was also an impeachment rather recently in South Korea, too.
There is a difference between sort of newer democracies and more established, older democracies. You find impeachment in both categories. you don't see that many impeachments in countries like France, for instance, where the democracy is more established, more kind of adhering to customs and long-established rules.
Now, Rick, I think what's kind of neat about your position is that you're sort of looking at impeachment, especially in the context of the United States, from a distance. So what is the perspective there in Europe as we're going through this impeachment process here? Is it seen more as a dysfunction, or is it seen as something about the American system that seems to be working?
Well, I think given Donald Trump's very low approval ratings in Europe, many are quite frankly surprised it has taken that long. I think a lot of people here see it as a sign of a functioning democracy, and frankly quite something that they're a little jealous of, because it is a very extensive process that still very much allows Congress to exert control. At the same time, there are some concerns over the way it has become politicized in the United States and isn't a sort of bipartisan tool some had envisioned in the past.
What's left for countries without an impeachment tool?
Well, in some countries, such as parliamentary democracies, often you have very kind of rudimentary processes such as no-confidence votes, where just sometimes a simple majority is needed to get rid of a prime minister, for instance. In other countries, you don't really have such tools to get rid of leaders unless there's a coup d'etat, for instance.
Rick Nowak reports for the Washington Post from Berlin. We'll link to his interesting piece at texasstandard.org. Rick, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard.
Sure. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's a Friday. Let's check in with our social media editor, Wells Dunbar, find out what people are talking about on this last day of the work week.
Hi, David. Well, we're hearing from people about the show's top story, Houston Police Chief Art Acevedo and his war of words with Texas top Republicans. The chief saying GOP leaders in Congress were too afraid of retaliation from the National Rifle Association to support closing that so-called boyfriend loophole in the Violence Against Women Act. You're either here for women and children, or you're here for the NRA, Acevedo said. Well, on our Facebook page, Sherry Kleitz says, domestic violence calls have always been the most dangerous calls for police due to the abuser having a perfect situation to ambush. NRA leadership has been overtly in-your-face, defiant, nasty, and entitled paranoid and militant, Sherry writes. The group encouraged and promoted responsible marksmanship and gun safety for families once, has unfortunately morphed into a financial machine designed to sell military-grade artillery and arms to anyone who can pay. That is irresponsible, and the reason we're in the situation the Houston chief is complaining about. Meanwhile, Dean Gobble says Chief Acevedo's words are out of step with Texas and would be better suited to California, where Acevedo served on the Highway Patrol. Lots of chatter about this one. You know, also keeping an eye on that vote to proceed with full impeachment proceedings in the U.S. House, clearing the House Judiciary Committee. Another top story out there people are chiming in about on social media.
You know, I'm surprised not more people are talking about that incredible election in the U.K., which is really fascinating stuff. What's making news where you are? Tweet us right now, won't you, at Texas Standard.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
Business and your money on the Standard. I'm David Brown. Big news coming down earlier this week for aspiring hemp farmers. At long last, the Texas Department of Agriculture has released a proposed set of rules for growing the crop. After decades of being illegal, the 2018 Farm Bill cleared the way for hemp production. These new rules will help would-be growers understand how the crop will be regulated. It's a big step, but there's still a long way to go from seeds to eventual stems. The Texas Standard's Michael Marks explains.
There are a lot of people in Texas excited about growing hemp. The crop has big profit potential thanks in large part to the boom in CBD products. But experts are cautioning would-be growers to be very careful before they take a big leap. One of the reasons for that is that growing hemp is just one part of the equation. Another is processing it, extracting CBD oil or breaking the plant down so you can use its fiber. The problem is that as of now, there are no hemp processing facilities in Texas, but that's going to change.
We're expecting the gin to process around 130,000 tons of Texas-grown industrial hemp on an annual basis.
That's Bill Pentak, the spokesperson for Panda Biotech, describing the capabilities of the High Plains Hemp Gin. Earlier this week, the Dallas-based company announced that it secured the rights to buy a 255,000-square-foot facility in Shallow Water, a cotton country town about 10 miles northwest of Lubbock.
We think that hemp crops are very complementary to cotton, and we can certainly see them growing side by side.
This is a big deal because while there's no shortage of Texans interested in growing hemp, Panda Biotech is one of the few players to announce concrete plans to process it. Doing so requires a substantial investment. You need a lot of space and specialized equipment to harvest hemp fiber, which you can then use to make everything from textiles to insulation, car interiors to hempcrete, a flame-retardant construction material. What the company's gin won't do, though, is extract CBD. Even though hemp early adopters in other states made a lot of money off CBD, Pentak said that Panda Biotech's gin will only produce the plant's fiber.
We think that using hemp for manufacturing applications, we think it's a growing market, and we think it's a more sustainable market.
The Texas Department of Agriculture will likely begin issuing licenses to grow hemp in February or March of 2020. Panda Biotech's hemp gin could be up and running by this time next year. For the Texas Standard, I'm Michael Marks.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. iPhones, Tesla batteries, high-tech military equipment, inside all manner of modern technologies, you may well find materials known as rare earth elements. The name betrays the fact that these elements are actually relatively common in the Earth's crust, even so. Most of them are mined in China, something that amid trade war concerns has the U.S. Army concerned. Now the military is looking into funding rare earth mines on U.S. soil in what could be its most significant investment in commercial rare earth production since the Manhattan Project. Some of those mines may end up in Texas. Ernest Scheider is covering the story for Reuters, where he reports on the mining industry. Ernest, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Great to be here, David.
It's my understanding that the United States used to be the prime producer, I should say, mining country when it came to rare earths. But in fact, China has taken that number one slot, right?
Correct. The rare earth industry really got its genesis in the United States, as you were saying, linked to the Manhattan Project and the development of the atomic bomb. But over the years after that, as the electronics industry grew in East Asia, China, and Japan, demand for rare earths for things like color televisions and other electronics caused those countries to invest a lot in the rare earth industry. So that's why we see China sort of cornering the market today.
And when you say cornering the market, is it true that China has sort of hung this over the Trump administration's head, so to speak? I mean, as these trade war tensions have ratcheted up, it's my understanding that China has suggested that they just might prevent the U.S. from having access to rare earth metals. Is that right?
Correct, yes. China definitely is using its monopoly over the rare earth market to its advantage in its trade dispute with President Trump's administration. Chinese President Xi, earlier this year, visited a rare earth facility in his country, and that was broadly seen as an implicit threat that the country could stop exports to the United States. China's done this before. In 2010, they stopped exports to Japan after a diplomatic trade dispute between China and Japan. That sent prices for rare earths spiking, and that definitely got a lot of folks in the U.S. military interested and also worried that China one day could do the same to the United States.
And so I presume that's why the U.S. thinks now might be the time to start to DIY this thing.
Yes. To use the Home Depot analogy, rare earths have become a lot more popular now because they help electronics get smaller. That's sort of an oversimplification, but think of your iPhone. The device in the iPhone that vibrates is made with rare earths. Now, there are no known substitutes out there at all. So we can live without a vibrating iPhone, probably, but if you're the U.S. military and you're charged with the national defense, you really need rare earths to go into things like night vision goggles, missiles, bombs, and other weaponry. So the U.S. Army and the broader U.S. military is concerned from a strategic defense perspective that relying on China for these items could imperil their ability to protect the homeland.
This is sort of a two-step process because you have to mine the rare earth minerals and then you have to actually process it, which can be a pretty a messy business. What are they talking about possibly doing in Texas?
Sure. So in West Texas, there's a large deposit called the Round Top Deposit. It's being developed by two companies that are jointly working together. And the deposit has a lot of what are called light and heavy rare earths. Now the military really wants a heavy rare earth because those go into a lot of weaponry. And the joint venture partners that are developing that asset want to develop the mine, of course, but then also on site build a processing unit to basically produce those rare earth elements from the ore in the ground. And so their hope is that this will be a purely domestic project right now.
But it also seems like this really is quite a shot over the bow of China, not just because the United States might be investing in it, but because this, at least in theory, if you have the defense infrastructure now investing in this as an industry, this could be the start of something big, at least when it comes to entrepreneurship.
Correct. I think a lot of folks in the U.S. rare earth industry are hoping that's exactly what happens here. The problem with a lot of modern mining projects is that investors get really skittish because a lot of mining projects fail when they're right out of the bat, especially junior mining projects. So if you have an entity like the U.S. government and its large balance sheet behind you, that's seen as a sure bet by industry. Also, the assumption is, of course, that the U.S. military would buy the rare earths from these facilities, and that would have an underpinning or guaranteed source of revenue. So that could help these companies go out and then get more private industry loans to expand. So that's sort of the hope that this will be the genesis by which a whole new cottage industry in the United States grows.
Sounds like it could be the start of something big. Ernest Scheider is covering this story for Reuters, where he's been reporting on the mining industry. Ernest, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us.
Great to be here, David.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where Horned Frogs strive to be a force for the greater good. Stories of TCU faculty, student, and alumni changemakers can be explored online at leadon.tcu.edu. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. The five U.S. representatives from Texas on the House Judiciary Committee have stuck with their parties in voting on two articles of impeachment against President Trump this morning. Republicans John Ratcliffe and Louie Gohmert both voted no.
Mr. Chairman, may I ask how I'm recorded?
How is the gentleman recorded?
Mr. Gohmert, you are recorded as no.
Yeah, I want to make sure.
Texas Democrats Sheila Jackson Lee, Sylvia Garcia, and Veronica Escobar voted to approve the articles of impeachment, sending them to the full House for a vote next week. Texans have until Sunday to purchase plans on healthcare.gov, the online marketplace created by the Affordable Care Act. Houston Public Media's Sasha Cordner reports more than a million people in the state are expected to sign up.
So far, about 538,000 Texans have enrolled in the online health insurance marketplace. That's according to Elena Marks with Houston-based nonprofit Episcopal Health Foundation. While that number may seem low, she says it actually follows a pattern.
Last year, at this same point in time, our enrollment was only 542,000. And so it seems that across the country, including in Texas, there is a huge surge in enrollment in that last week. And so we're expecting to see the trend in Texas be similar to what it was last year.
About 1.1 million Texans signed up for health plans during the last enrollment period. I'm Sasha Cordner in Houston.
Increased oil and gas production has led to a spike in earthquakes in Texas over the last decade or so, but the man-made tremors will not be included in the new earthquake hazard map from the U.S. Geological Survey. As KUT's Mose Bouchel reports, some previous maps did include the risk.
This earthquake hazard map forecasts the long-term risk of powerful earthquakes striking an area. It's used to set building standards in places where quakes are likely. After the oil and gas boom set off a surge of quakes in Texas and Oklahoma in 2008, the USGS started including that quake history in some long- and short-term projections. But this year, the long-term map will not take man-made quakes into account, says Mark Peterson, USGS seismologist.
If we use those kinds of numbers, then people in Dallas, Fort Worth would be designing to a very high standard.
He says man-made quakes became less frequent after the slowdown in the oil field in 2011. Texas and Oklahoma have also introduced some regulation to curb quakes. But now that the oil boom is back on, quakes seem to be on the rise in some parts of Texas.
KUT's Mose Bouchel reporting from Austin. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, family-owned, operated, and argued over since 1980, reminding listeners to think for themselves, but drink with others. SierraNevada.com.
You got to tune to the Texas Standard. Oil production in the Permian Basin has been a driving force in the state's economy and a big reason why the U.S. is the largest oil and gas producer in the world. If you've been out to West Texas recently, you can't have missed the tall pipe shooting flames into the air, burning off natural gas, a byproduct of the boom in oil extraction. That's wasteful of the energy content, to be sure, and it releases a lot of CO2 into the atmosphere, too. But that's better than having all that methane being released into the air, the industry tells you. Which scientists say is a powerful greenhouse gas, of course, but it's what the naked eye can't see that may be of more concern than previously thought. Hiroko Tabuchi is a reporter with the New York Times who, along with reporting partner Jonah Kessel, saw something from the sky that could very well shake things up in West Texas. Hiroko, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Maybe we should begin with what you and Jonah actually did here. You using a small plane, right?
Exactly. So we worked with a company that does surveys from the air of emissions, like methane emissions. Their planes are fitted with scientific equipment that can detect and measure methane levels from the air.
What did you find? I was taking a look at the flight patterns, and it seems like you would go from one oil patch to the next, sort of doing loops, circles, and taking pictures?
Well, from the air, we were actually just measuring the methane and just figuring out which sites were at that time emitting large amounts of methane. And we found quite a few sites. During a course of two short flights, we found six basically sites emitting methane at levels that scientists would likely call sort of super emitters, which means that they're sort of, they're spewing a lot more methane than you would expect from the oil and gas
installation. Super emitters. Now, just to be clear, methane is not visible to the naked eye, right?
Exactly. So methane is odorless. It's colorless. You cannot see it. You cannot smell it. And that's why then the second part of our reporting came into play when we armed with the knowledge with the readings that we got from the air. We then drove on the ground to those sites. And what we took with us is an infrared camera that does let us sort of visualize this invisible methane gas.
This is one of the most striking aspects of this kind of reporting, because what you see, you invite the reader to say, what do you see here? And then you in the next frame, you see what the camera, the infrared eye, sees, and you see enormous plumes of gas being emitted into the air. You describe them as super emitters. It's hard to argue with that. If, in fact, this is methane, which I guess is what the industry might say, well, are you really getting methane, or are you getting some other kind of gas here that you're seeing in this infrared?
Sure. And that's that's definitely, most likely the plume is not entirely methane. Our camera is it's calibrated to focus in on methane. On the other hand, that's just to entirely separate out methane is impossible. So we could be, we are likely seeing a combination of methane plus other pollutants that you actually also wouldn't want to see being emitted from these sites. By the way, VOCs, volatile organic compounds that have health implications, other types of greenhouse gases, that sort of thing.
But let's talk a little bit about the inconvenience for the industry here. This coming at your reporting, of course, coming at a time when the administration, Trump administration, is rolling back a lot of regulations when it comes to emissions from some of these facilities, right?
Exactly. So the Environmental Protection Agency has proposed basically eliminating requirements that oil companies install technology to detect and fix these methane leaks.
So did you show these pictures to these companies? How did they respond?
We did. We sent our images to all of the companies that we could identify. And we heard back from, we didn't hear back from some of them. One of the companies did get back to us and said, yes, the tank was leaking, but they fixed it within 30 minutes. But they weren't able to provide us with any other details on how long that leak had been going on before we pointed it out to them. And yeah.
They are images that once seen are hard to forget, about a vast, invisible climate menace suddenly made visible by the work of Hiroko Tabuchi and her reporting partner Jonah Kessel in the New York Times. We'll have a link to the piece at texasstandard.org. Ms. Tabuchi, thanks so much for spending a few minutes with us on the Texas Standard.
Thanks so much for having me.
We are coming up to 39 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard time. It's a whole lot more of the Standard just ahead. Stay with us.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas ABLE program, a tax advantage savings program helping eligible Texans with disabilities save for the future. Learn more, including how the program works with certain public benefits, at texasable.org.
Hello, I'm Jackie McBroom. I wrote Historic Texas Gems, a tribute to the vanishing traditions, and you're listening to the Texas Standard. In small town Texas, the gymnasium was often the cultural hub of the community. People got together, even if their kids weren't playing basketball anymore. If it's Tuesday night in Texline, the folks are going to go to the gym to watch the Tornadoes play. The folks that live in those little towns have very clear memories of things that happened there. And for example, in Dawson, Texas, which is in central Texas, in the 50s, a plane crashed. And the federal investigators came in and commandeered the school gym as a makeshift morgue. So for several days, as worried loved ones came from all over the United States, the folks in Dawson would welcome these people who were scared and worried and so disturbed and so troubled. When the folks in Dawson see the old gym that's still right there on Main Street, they have a very different feeling than most people would who just drive through town and see an old red building sitting there across from City Hall. Schools all over, they have to watch every nickel. And if they even decide they love their old gym and they want to spend $1 million to renovate it, it's still going to be too small. It's still hot in the summertime and cold in the wintertime. The locker rooms are cramped. The bleachers are inadequate for the big numbers that might come to the game now. They're becoming more and more obsolete as schools have to move on. But they also have really tough decisions to make because the folks that live in that community, that was their gym. So they don't want it. They don't want it to go away. A lot of them are just used for storage. I've seen them with old school desks and textbooks, and very often they'll just tear it down. One thing about the book, it's not about great basketball games or great volleyball games. It's about things that happened in the gym or around the gym that had an impact on the folks in that community. For example, I have the story of really four war heroes from Ennis, Texas, that all played in the Ennis gym when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. They joined the Marine Corps together, got sent to to Asia together and ended up at Iwo Jima together, and they all died within a day of each other. Ennis has done a fine job of remembering who they are, but that's not good enough. We need to know who they are, and we need to know their story. There's a real feeling of nostalgia, I think, as you read the book, and we hearken back to better times, but they really weren't better. You know, they were very hard times. You know, it's stories of our greatest generation. You know, there's probably no one in my age group that doesn't remember these old gyms that your locker room is under the bleachers and you hear people stomping around and get excited and the cheerleaders starting to go to work and people clapping their hands and you just feel the excitement from above you, you know, and it's a real indelible part of growing up in Texas and its memories. I'm Jackie McBroom. I wrote Historic Texas Gyms, a Tribute to Vanishing Traditions, and you're listening to the Texas Standard.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
Hundreds of thousands of Texans live with dementia, but for those who don't suffer the effects, it can be hard to understand. Researchers at UT Health San Antonio have designed a variety of activities to guide visitors through the perspective of someone with dementia. As part of her ongoing look at the challenges in caring for people with dementia, Texas Public Radio's Bonnie Petrie took the tour.
Hi, ladies.
Hello.
My name is Brandy. I'm going to be facilitating the beginning of your virtual dementia tour
okay.
today.
Okay.
So what you're here for is a simulation just to kind of give you an idea of some of the things that people with dementia, Alzheimer's, go through.
The Virtual Dementia Tour at UT Health San Antonio is part of the Caring for the Caregiver program and starts when your tour facilitator presents you with a series of unusual items. You get a pair of glasses, a pair of mismatched gloves, a pair of inserts for your shoes, and a pair of headphones. You put on the glasses and notice the lenses are a murky yellow with a black circle surrounding the center, a cloudy bullseye. The gloves are bulky and the one for your dominant hand has fingers sewn together. The shoe inserts are covered with small spikes and the headphones are playing unsettling static.
You ready?
Me?
Yes, ma'am.
All right.
You follow your facilitator toward a room where you will be asked to perform several simple tasks. And those pointy inserts, they're digging in. They're supposed to give you a sense of what it might feel like to live with peripheral neuropathy with its tingling and numbness. You stick close to your facilitator because those glasses, they create the effect of tunnel vision, something many people with dementia experience.
Okay.
This is Breon. He's going to be reading your instructions to you.
Since my headphones were playing static in my ears, I removed one.
I do need you to keep both headphones on, so apologize for that.
Okay. Headphones on. Now, the instructions.
Find the pants and put the belt through the belt loops.
Okay.
Take 3 pills out of 2 prescription bottles and place them in the cup.
Okay.
Clear the table. Write down 7 things that are brown that you buy at the grocery store. Okay. Set the clock for 8:50. Those are your instructions. You can come and take
it. Here we go. All right. More sounds. And what were those instructions? Belt in belt loops, clear the table, write down things that are brown at a grocery store, get the pills, and set the clock. With hands that don't work like they should, and eyes that don't work like they should, and feet that hurt, and all this noise. So how'd it go? Doris Francis did the tour with me. Her mom has Alzheimer's.
I didn't know what to expect, but it blew my mind. I had no idea that some things were that severe for feeling and touch and sight. No idea that it was that severe.
Sharon Overmeyer did the tour with her sister, Sandra McMillan. They share caregiving duties for their mother, Mary.
Oh my gosh, that was amazing. Very frustrating for me, though. But I can understand why it's frustrating for her.
And you find yourself talking to yourself, trying to realize, okay, he said to do this first, then this, and I find that I was doing it all different. So I understand what she's feeling.
And Caring for the Caregiver Program Director, Carol White, says empathy is what this exercise is all about.
What we hear commonly when people debrief after going through that is, I'm going to be more patient, I'm going to have a better understanding of what my loved one is going through.
Now, anyone can go on this tour. It's free, and you can sign up at the UT Health San Antonio School of Nursing website. Around 390,000 people in Texas are living with dementia, and according to the Department of State Health Services, most of their care is coming from unpaid caregivers, usually family members. Reporting for the Texas Standard, I'm Bonnie Petrie.
Support for Texas Standard comes from RAND Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
My name is David Fruchter, and I am with the Typewriter Rodeo. Group of friends, writers, who take our vintage manual typewriters, and we type poems on request for anyone who comes up and asks us for a poem. Lone Star Playlist. If you are privileged to take a drive across this expanse of a state, don't you neglect to cue up some Willie and Waylon, if it's not too late. Some Ornette, some Buddy, some Queen Beyoncé, some Lyle and some Lucinda, too. Some Jimmy Dale, Jerry Jeff, and Billy Joe. Selena and Janice sang true. Stevie Ray, Jimmy, and Robert Earl. Lightning and T-Bone, Sir Doug. Nowadays, you can just load them all on your phone. No 100 CDs must you lug. Eureka and Flacco, Rocky and Sly, Augie and Ernest and Ray. There's enough Texas music for your whole road trip, even if it takes 10 days. Long Texas days. My name is David Fruchter, and I am with the Typewriter Rodeo. You're listening to the Texas Standard.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
Hey, got an idea for a poem? Let us know. Send us your requests on social media or shoot us an email, texasstandard@kut.org. You can keep up with the Typewriter Rodeo anytime on iTunes or wherever fine podcasts are served. Time now to turn to the week in Texas politics, as we do every Friday. Here with us today, Alex Samuels, political reporter for the Texas Tribune. Alex, welcome back to the big broadcast.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
This week marked the last day candidates could file for the March 3rd primaries in Texas. And I guess you could say there are some crowded races. Look at that U.S. Senate race for the seat held by John Cornyn.
Right. There are nearly a dozen Democrats lined up for that seat there. Of course, there are some who are a little ahead in polls or believe they are the front runners in that race. But it's interesting that a lot of Democratic voters are undecided on who they'll support. Cornyn pretty much has the race tied up on the Republican side. I think that's fair to say. He does have a couple primary challengers, but on the Democratic side, it's definitely a pretty crowded race.
Some other names as a result of the Friday deadline. One, apparently a member of the Bush dynasty, right?
Right. So Pierce Bush has a file to run in Texas's 22nd congressional district. He's the grandson of the late President George H.W. Bush. He's another late entry into the race. And as you said, a member of the Bush dynasty, he definitely has the name ID working in his favor. But he's at least one of at least 17 Republicans running for that seat. So it's by no means a surefire win for him.
Speaking of a packed roster of candidates, let's move on up to Texas 13, the U.S. Congress. There's a former White House doctor who is in the running, right? Or at least he's declared his candidacy.
Correct. Yeah. So Ronnie Jackson, as you mentioned, the former White House doctor, and he was also President Trump's one-time nominee to be the Secretary of Veteran Affairs, is running to replace Mac Thornberry in the 13th District. Another late entry into the race, another very crowded primary. At least 13 Republicans have looked at that race.
There's a new CNN poll this week that indicates that there's one clear frontrunner among Texas Democratic primary voters in the presidential race. It is not, for the record, a Texan.
Right. So former Vice President Joe Biden is the leading contender in the 2020 Democratic primary here in Texas. He has a 20-point lead over his closest opponent in Texas, also not a Texan. So Biden netted about 35% of the vote among likely Texas Democratic primary voters. Bernie Sanders, who was in second place, raked in about 15% support, and then Elizabeth Warren right behind Sanders at 13%.
So why do you think Julian Castro, the former mayor of San Antonio and ex-HUD secretary, isn't doing better in his home state?
That's a good question. I think that's one that we're still trying to figure out, and Castro's obviously looking at as well. In this poll, he only had 3% support. You know, I think he'll chalk that up to name ID, the fact that he's not raising enough money. You know, Biden and Warren both have really robust campaigns here in Texas. Both have hired Texas state directors. Castro has not yet. So I think Castro's still looking to shore up his name ID and fundraising. And of course, he missed the last debate and he'll miss the next debate. So he doesn't have that national platform that these other candidates do.
Alex Samuels with the Texas Tribune. Alex, thanks so much and have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
And you were listening to the Texas Standard. Joining us once again in the studio, it's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. What are you seeing out there, Wells?
Hey, David. You know, we just heard a moment ago about another Bush, Pierce Bush. Well, another Bush, yet another Bush in the news. And this is a wild story. Texas Land Commissioner George P. Bush vigorously disputing baseless rumors that he plans to put a statue of Santa Ana at the Alamo. Talk about your only in Texas political controversies here. You know, we've reported our fair share about plans to change the area surrounding the so-called Shrine of Texas Liberty. It has not been without controversy, including things like plans to move the Alamo Cenotaph, for one. But it seems as if political rivals are now planning this fake story that Bush plans to honor Santa Ana there instead. One such group, called Save the Alamo, posted on Facebook that Bush intended to, quote, erect a statue of the dictator Santa Ana and a memorial honoring the Mexican army. I am not making this up, close quote. Well, apparently they were. San Antonio news site The Rivard Report notes that the group made the claim, the group that made the claim, was headed by a former land commissioner candidate who faced off against Bush in the 2018 Republican primary. So, yeah, some sour grapes there, it sounds like. George P. Bush, the incumbent land commissioner there, taking to Twitter to push back against all this. He wrote this week in part, "One must ask themselves, why am I being accused of honoring the murderous dictator Santa Ana? Is it because my mother, now a naturalized citizen, is from Mexico? I was born in Houston, my wife is from San Angelo, and my boys were born, you guessed it, here in Texas." He went on to say, "The idea that I would ever place a statue of Santa Ana at the Alamo is patently false. Enough is enough. This is an outright lie and is quite frankly flat out racist."
Well,
yeah. So pushing back very vehemently against that. And I guess I would, too, probably, if someone accused me of planning as much. And, you know, people talking about this on social media as well on our Facebook page, Randall Munro. He says he basically sums up the whole controversy thusly. He says, "Yeah, that's never going to happen." And don't really see that happening.
No, I don't. I don't see it happening either. I mean, I totally understand where Commissioner Bush is coming from there. It is interesting, though. There's a whole lot of change that's going to be coming to the Alamo Plaza. Yeah. I remember Commissioner Bush's predecessor talking about the plans, and they've been drawing them up for some time.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of amazing that this place, you can walk right up to it, touch it. You know, just it's right there, and there's this open plaza. That openness is probably going to start disappearing quite a bit. It's going to be a completely different place, and I think a lot of people who may have been underwhelmed after all the myth and legend around
it. Yeah, and just speaking, this controversy speaking to those broader anxieties.
Yes, right. Absolutely. I think that's quite true. It's going to be a different place. Hey, listen, we're out of time for the big broadcast, but we're going to be back here on Monday, and we hope you will join us. Till then, I'm David Brown, along with Wells Dunbar and the rest of the crew, wishing you a wonderful weekend.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family. Would your company or organization like to be a sponsor as well? Contact your local station for opportunities within your community. For statewide sponsorships, visit TexasPublicMediaNetwork.com.